over at ECCL.
Whoa.
Okay. I can't see, but Emeryville Center for Community Life, where the school district is, and the recreation department.
Okay, so today is Wednesday, May 6th, and we are here for our City of Emeryville Housing Committee meeting. The meeting is called to order at 6:06 p.m. The meeting is being audio and video recorded, and staff will take roll call at this time.
Okay, I'm just going to go around the table. So, Member Brooks?
Here.
Member Jen?
Here.
Member Wendy? Here.
Member Tyler?
Here.
Member Julia?
Here.
Member Ellen? Chair Ellen?
Yes.
And then Member Dolores Johnson, she is out today, but we do have a quorum.
Awesome. So now it's time for public comments.
I didn't get anything related to the meeting.
Okay. And so we will move on to item number four, approval of the the April 1st meeting minutes. I'll motion to approve. I'll second. Okay. I'll call.
Member Denzel.
Aye.
Member Oakley.
Aye.
Member Medeiros.
Do I say hi even though I wasn't here?
Yes. You
do. Okay.
Member Hill.
Aye.
Member Drummond.
Yes.
Chair Strauss.
Yes.
Great. Minutes are approved.
And we will now move to item 6.1, temporary relocation assistance.
My screen is looking different. So there we go. Okay. So temporary relocation assistance. So there was a request from the City Council for us to add to as a future agenda item, looking at temporary relocation assistance. Mm-hmm. It is not a part of our original work plan related to our tenant protections. And so our consultant is not assigned to that component of the work. However, we have kept it in the back pocket of something that we needed to do. And so I am trying, with Emily's help, to try to act as a consultant in some sort of way and pull together the research and the information related to temporary relocation assistance so that we can attempt to try to incorporate it into the tenant protection project that we currently are working on that'll go to you guys in City Council later this year. What exactly is temporary relocation assistance policy? It really is a housing stability tool. Its job is to provide compensation for a tenant who is required to vacate their unit due to no cause of their own on a temporary basis. So not the same thing that would happen under an eviction where it's a permanent basis. This is just intended to be a short term. It's usually related to, again, issues that are out of the control of the tenant, and the landlord would then be required to cover costs during that time that the tenant is removed from the unit. The tenant has the automatic ability, of course, to return to the unit when the repairs are finished and the unit is habitable again. So who does that? We looked at eight different cities, City of Alameda, Berkeley, Concord, Hayward, Oakland, Richmond, San Francisco, and San Mateo all have a tenant temporary relocation policy. Additionally, the state of California also enacted a policy in 2024 that became effective in 2025 called SB 1465. Okay. So in trying to determine what components, if we're creating a policy, what are the things that we need to think of? And so I've identified seven different things through the research that Emily provided are things that we need to think about as we're creating our policy and that are different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So one, we need to be clear about what makes somebody eligible. Be very explicit about when we're talking about someone's eligible for relocation assistance, what is happening that is triggering their ability in order to receive it? Mm-hmm. And are there any kind of housing units that we want to say are exempt? We want to make sure that we standardize whatever the benefit structure is. That is, that it's not a case-by-case basis scenario, that we kind of really define how we're calculating what that benefit is, what does it, and what does it cover. Most cities don't, but this did come up as a best practice of whether or not there's a relocation plan that is provided to the tenant and or the city that identifies exactly what the work that's being done, who's going to be affected by it, what are the temporary housing options that might be available to the tenant. And so in thinking about if we want to do that, is that something that requires city approval or something that just has to be submitted to the tenant and maybe a copy to the city? We need to think about that. Determining when payments are going to be due to the tenant. Are there any notification requirements? How are the tenants being notified of what their rights are related to the policy? Are there any enforcement requirements? So is there a penalty for noncompliance? Is it a private right of action? Does the city step in and make the payment? And if so, are there recovery options that the city has at its disposal? And then administration. This is really the biggest thing. What role does the city have? And is it something that could be contracted out? Or maybe it's not a role that the city has, but it's more of that private right. So it's something between the tenant and landlord. We create the parameters just like we do with our just cause eviction, but there actually is not an administrative role for the city to play. And so as we go through the different components, I want you guys to try to always think about that administrative question, because depending upon how we think about structuring this program, will help us determine whether or not there's an administrative cost. And so when we put this program together and bring it to City Council, that's going to be something that they're going to have to opine on and determine whether or not they want to move forward, especially if there's an administrative cost. I will say most of the jurisdictions we looked at do have a series of staff members that are assigned to administer this policy. Now, it is in addition to their other rent protection programs. A lot of them have rent stabilization or rent control. A lot of them have a rental registry. So this is just another additional task of the work that they're performing, but they do have dedicated staff to do this.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
So I forget his name, and I know as soon as you say it, but he came and he spoke with us about, I thought the city of Emeryville does offer temporary or relocation. I thought they offered like 3 months of market rate. Is that for
that's permanent. So that is if you're going through a no-fault eviction.
Okay.
The no-fault eviction policy requires the landlord to pay rent depending on if it's a small or large landlord. But that is only if you're going through an eviction.
His name is Chadwick Smalley.
Okay. So Chad's our director.
So what are we talking about when we're talking about payment? Like agreeing to pay their
we're gonna get there.
So this is just temporary.
This is only if somebody is being required to temporarily move out of their unit for a purpose. Okay. So the first thing to look at is what is the trigger for eligibility? So what has happened? So under the state law, temporary relocation is only provides a trigger for if there was a government order issued forcing the tenant to move out of the unit. So code enforcement or the courts, or I don't know, usually it's going to be a code enforcement case that they've determined that the unit is uninhabitable and that it is not safe for occupancy. So that's what the state law states. City of Oakland, their policy covers government orders as well as code enforcement cases. City of Alameda, government order and health and safety issues. And the wording that they all use is also very different. Berkeley says the city has to issue a determination that the unit is unsafe for occupancy. And that determination is made through the course of doing code compliance. Hayward says significant repairs related to code compliance, major remodeling, or damaging that happened through a natural event. Hayward also has a subsection. They have put the government code within to their policy. So they distinguish between the government code following the state guidelines and then if you're one of those other categories. Concord says substantial repair in government order. And San Francisco says they have a policy for lead. And then their other policies for capital improvements and rehab. So we're going to have to figure out, like, what we want to, do we want to follow kind of like what the state does and follow their order, or do we want to expand it a little bit beyond just a government order, which means that the city or the county has issued something stating that the unit is not habitable.
The thing, health and safety issue, and then substantial repair, and then government order, and then code compliance. Those are all interchangeable.
Yeah,
meaning the same thing.
Which is why the wording will be important.
Yeah.
Because I totally agree, but I wanted to write it this way because that's how they state it.
Oh.
And one of the things that we've recognized is that it's very critical, and while we're working on it, to have a definition of terms.
Mm-hmm.
Because people can interpret things different way. I interpret a lot of these to mean the same thing, but they're using different words. And whether or not they actually mean it to mean the same thing or not, I don't know. So that's definitely one of our top priorities as we're revising our ordinance, is to have definitions of what we mean when we say, like, we were going to say something like health and safety. What does that mean?
But that's leaving discretionary to the city and not.
It's not, because they have their health and safety. They have definitions, like they've defined
the
health
state,
and safety.
The
state, oh, the state.
The state has health and safety codes, correct.
Yeah. So does that mean that the city is making discretionary decisions about what they mean exactly?
That's potentially, yeah, we could.
But I'm saying that those cities have each their definitions of all those health and safety.
Yeah, but it's discretionary, because if it's, the state says something, like, what supersedes the city's discretionary definition of something, as opposed to who decides what is really what and what triggers what if it's discretionary?
Well, I mean, if we put it in our, if we put a definition, that would take the discretion away from it. Outside of right now, cities have the ability in determining if there's a government ordered issue, what meets those standards for that government order. If we go beyond that, then let's say that we created a policy that said if you were doing significant repair that costs more than X dollar or that impacts more than three systems, that would be a discretion that the city has made that does something beyond what the state says, but that would be a decision that the city says, I want to be able to assist that. The state doesn't give that allowance. The city would be giving that allowance. Now, it could be that we say it's based on two major systems in the house or three, but those are things that, yes, the city would have the discretion of determining what that definition is, and we would write it into the code so that it would be clear to everybody.
And that's what I'm saying, each city has. They've made their own definitions of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not like they're just, you know, they're just making this language and then not defining that. They've all defined it. We just don't know how they each define it, right?
They don't all have definitions. No,
yeah,
that's the problem.
Really.
They're not defined.
And
no.
You have to follow compliance as opposed to compliance as far as federal and state things. How do you follow that compliance if you've taken yourself out of the definition of what is considered compliance by federal or state if it's not considered compliance? If it's not your definition.
Well, and that's the whole point of coming up with a definition.
That's what we're trying to do.
To alleviate that exact problem.
Okay.
So like a good example would be under Alameda, if we decided to do something similar to what they have, they say health and safety issues. We would then want to write a definition of what we consider health and safety issues that are not necessarily a government code. So that could be something like lead hazards, or if there was asbestos. Mm-hmm. It could be that we've had a case where somebody had feces running through the wall from a broken pipe, right? Those would be health and safety issues. We would want to talk about, like, what are the different kind of examples of things that could constitute a health and safety. But what we would want to do is come up with that definition. And right now we don't have definitions, so it is much more up to the building official for some things and the code enforcement officer collectively to determine whether or not something's a health and safety violation. Even when it comes to Hayward and Concord with their substantial or significant repairs, I don't know how they're defining that. I mean, that could mean something complete. I mean, if I take my floors out, is that a substantial repair?
I mean, but
I'm like, remodeling my kitchen. Like, I don't know, but we would need to come up with the definition.
Right.
So it's like a second layer from the state.
Right.
So the state has their policies or rules around it. And then we can.
If we want to create something that creates more protections, we can do that. And that's what we would want to. We'd want to get feedback from you guys as to, okay, what are the things that we should make sure that we're covering?
Mm-hmm.
Next, how long is displacement for? So you could have a policy that has a minimum threshold. Let's say this would be a great example. I would only recommend us doing a minimum threshold if we're going to keep things that are rehab work or repair work, saying that somebody has to be out of the unit more than X number of consecutive nights. If we're not going to do that, and we're going to keep it related to government orders or code enforcement issues, then we definitely need to have a maximum threshold. And what that maximum threshold varies from 20 days in San Francisco down to 90 days in San Mateo.
We could do both, right?
We could. No, we always are going to have a maximum threshold. The question is, do we want a minimum threshold? We may not have to have one. It could be if you're gone one day, then here's the policy. Yeah. Or we could say, no, you have to be gone for your unit more than X number of days in order to be eligible for relocation assistance. I will say one thing that we're going to need to keep in mind, and this just was brought to my attention today, we need to think about this, is if we have a policy that goes beyond 30 days, is somebody establishing tenancy somewhere else?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
So I don't know how these other cities deal with that, but that's something that we need to think about. I would say 30 days is what's most common, but we need to think about if we decide to do something beyond 30 days, how do we ensure that that person is not triggering tenancy at their new location?
Well, and also, it makes me I think you probably have the answer to this, but also doesn't it lean into, it's not necessarily an eviction, but you can't be in your place. So how do you navigate that? Is it if the tenant is in agreeance to the remodels that are happening that's causing them to be displaced? Like, what if this is causing them to essentially be evicted because they have to create new tenancy?
So this is one of the things, I'm glad you brought that up. I don't have a slide on that we're trying to address.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to distinguish the difference, because our policy currently doesn't, between having to vacate your unit for a temporary purpose versus having to vacate your unit for a permanent purpose through an eviction.
Mm-hmm.
We want to create a distinction between the two. And right now our policy doesn't address what happens if there was a code enforcement case that said you had to be that you had to leave your unit. Right now, the only option is for an eviction. Well, that doesn't really make sense. They technically shouldn't be evicted. They're being forced to leave because there's a government order saying they can't live in the unit because it's uninhabitable. But we didn't have that in our policy. So this is trying to address that and create a tiering of distinguishing between what a temporary relocation is or a temporary vacancy of your unit versus an actual eviction, and create a separation instead of what happens right now is that they're kind of mushed together.
And can you, within our making of these regulations or policies, are we allowed to put some stipulation in there where the tenant has more say in how they feel about it? Like if 30 days...
I have not seen anybody that has that. There is choices that the tenant has, but as to whether or not they want to leave their unit, that doesn't seem to be a tenant's choice.
Oh, I'm sorry. In the scenario that it goes over 30 days, and then at what point, if the tenant is willing to wait 60 more days.
Oh, but there's a section on that too.
But they don't want to wait 60 more days, and then they feel that it's a false eviction because of the...
No, there is something to address that.
Okay.
So, okay, sorry, I'll get there. I don't think it's next. So, what are the benefits? There actually are three benefits. These are the first two. One, all of the cities require the landlord the ability to offer alternative housing in lieu of payment. However, it is the tenant's decision as to whether or not they want to take the alternative housing or they want to take the payment. However, Berkeley, Hayward, Alameda, and San Francisco, if they provide comparable housing, they also require the landlord to cover the tenant's moving cost from their current unit to the new unit. All of the cities also require that the landlord provide the tenant the right to return to the unit once the work is complete and the unit has been determined safe for occupancy. So those are two benefits. The third benefit is the payment. So there's a variation as to how people determine what is being paid for and how you calculate it. So Oakland and San Mateo both have the reimbursement based on actual costs that the tenant will incur, and there is a cap on what those actual costs are. Their ordinance allows the reimbursement for hotels, meals, moving costs, and storage. All the other jurisdictions, including the state, they calculate that payment based off of a fixed cost. So it's not based on what the actual expenses are. It's a fixed payment amount that everybody is eligible to receive. So under the state, if you are receiving a government order to leave your unit, the landlord is required to give you 2 months of fair market rent, plus your utility deposit, and return your security deposit to you. The state also does not care how many days you are out of the unit for. So if your unit has been determined uninhabitable, you could be out of that unit for 2 days, and that's what you get, or you could be out of that unit for 60 days, and that's what you get. Hayward does 3 times the fair market rent, prorated for the number of actual days you were out of the unit, plus a reimbursement of the moving cost. Alameda and Richmond give you a per diem rate that will cover hotels, meals, laundry, and pets. And San Francisco and Concord give you a per diem rate only related to hotels and meals.
So, one thing that I don't see on there that I'm wondering, like, do they give you payment for being off work for the days that you are moving?
No.
I mean, I feel like that is such an expense that people, I mean, I would have to take a day off work. I don't care if the moving company was moving me or not, but I would have to take a day off work in order to like deal with all the moving and stuff and to unpack all my stuff. And so I feel like at least one adult should be, you know, paid back for a day off work on both situations, like when you get there and then when you get back home.
Mm-hmm. I think it's probably made up in like the fair market rate portion because it's covering what an expense would be maybe from your
not the per diem rate, not the actual cost rate, just on the fair market value rate.
So I wouldn't want to go with either of the per diem rates.
I think the 2 times the fair market rent with the state, the way the state does it, is not fair to the landlord.
Well, we can mix these things, right? It doesn't have to be an exact replica of it.
I'm just showing you guys what we've seen, what other people have done, and when they've created their policy for reference.
Yeah.
One problem is that I think, so first of all, rents is usually not as much as a hotel, right? So if you're getting reimbursed for your rent, I mean, that's why you don't live in a hotel, right? I mean, it's like less expensive to have a monthly rent. And so if it's just rent, that may not cover a hotel for the same amount of time. If it was a month of rent, that's not going to cover a month of hotel. At least that's my experience. And
well, it's 2 times or 3 times.
Right.
A hotel is going to be 2 times or 3 times.
So exactly. I'm going to jump up real quick because I did pull.
Exactly. So I think that's why it's
fair market rents.
I agree. Yeah.
So let's say we're just talking about a one bedroom.
This is current.
These are for 2026. Yeah. Okay. So a one bedroom fair market rent is $2,385. Mm-hmm. And if we did two times,
I think that is.
This is Emeryville?
No, that, but
Emeryville doesn't exist. So when you put in Emeryville, you're going to get the Oakland Fremont fair market rents. And when you put it in for per diem under the government code, you're going to get Oakland.
But that daily lodging rate, that's not for Emeryville hotels. Are those current rates? Maybe.
Yeah, these are current October 25th to September.
So if you are in an efficiency, that's two times that rent. So that's 2,300, right? That's 40. I'm sorry, 4,300. A hotel at $150 a night for 31 days is $4,600.
Yeah, exactly. So you can
move in for with the state's version. Yeah. Because the state is doing 2 months.
Yeah.
Right. Avery did 3 months.
Okay, and so let's see what that is.
And they do it on a per diem per day. So it's 3 months times the number of days you're out of your unit.
That would be 6,426. And so for a...
And then what would that be divided by?
For an efficiency. So then that would be divided by... That would be 214.
So that's,
which, I mean, you know...
214 a day.
A lot of them are going to be that much, you know, especially if you have two kids, you know, that are staying in a two-bedroom, you know, which is not that much more. You know, and then on top of that, you're going to have
government rate for the month of May is $145.
Oh, that's crazy.
I think also when you're looking up, it said like plus deposit utilities, like when you're in a hotel, you're not necessarily paying those things.
Wait, that's how much they'll give you is $145?
I guess.
No, per diem.
Yeah, your per diem for just hotel would be $145 a day.
That's not counting meals.
Wow.
That's not counting meals.
Oh, that's not counting.
No.
And I think if you looked right now at prices for hotels, let's say in Emeryville, it's going to be more than $145 a night.
Probably $200.
Yeah, probably closer to $200.
But if you ask for a rate for 30 days, it's going to be a little cheaper.
Possibly.
But also, then what about moving all your stuff? Does that mean you get a storage
unit? No, that's those were separate costs.
That's separate.
Right. So those were separate costs. The other thing I'll say is also remember this. Just because you are getting this per diem or the payment, there's no requirement that you actually go stay in a hotel. As a tenant, you go stay wherever you want. It's up to you to find where you want to go based on knowing what you're going to get.
You might not.
You could go end up staying with a friend, or you could go stay at a hotel three cities away. Like the landlord, the city has nothing. You do with the money as you wish. This is just how we're determining what the payment structure is.
You can't assume that anyone has a friend or a relative that they can stay with.
No, I just wanted to put that out there. Like, no one's checking that you did check in at the Hyatt. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
Also,
right.
For the three times market rate, to cover 3 months.
No, it's three times market rate prorated per day.
Okay, when you've been out of your unit.
Yes, for the number of days you're out.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to give you guys these references so you could kind of see. And this is only the lodging rate. It does not include foods or other costs. Mm-hmm. But since you guys were kind of asking the questions about the payment, I wanted to go back to here. That's why I say everybody does it differently as to what they cover and how they calculate it. So it's something.
The city has the discretion to say whether that's paid up front if they have foresight to say it's going to take 30 days.
That's another decision. Yes. Mm-hmm. Any other discussions about
that? Well, I was going to say, so hotels doesn't just have to mean hotels, right? Hotels can be long-term rentals, can be like Airbnbs.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. That's absolutely correct.
But I do think meals is important because if you're in a hotel, mm-hmm. now there are longer-term hotels, but most hotel rooms do not have a kitchen that you can cook in, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to eat out. And so I do think that meals is important, you know, for that kind of scenario. It's like otherwise it's going to cost you a lot more money to feed a family for a month if you can't cook at home.
Right. So remember also, Hayward does the three times the fair market rent and they're paying that as your lump sum.
Yeah.
How you divide that money up there's not an extra payment for meals.
Right.
When the cities that went to the per diem rate have the extra allocation for meals. The other thing is when we talk about per diem rate, I pulled the government code. Now we could come up with another reference point if you guys didn't feel like utilizing the government code was the accurate way. But that's, you know, if we decide that we want to go the per diem rate and then figuring out what, you know, makes sense for what you're paying for and what's going to be reasonable.
Because if you just say, okay, you get a hotel, doesn't have to be in the same city, right? Now, your commute, like if you have a job, like maybe you now have to, you have to figure out a whole new commute system. Maybe you have to pay more to commute. Maybe, it takes you longer to get, I don't know. There's a lot of other potential impacts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think just looking at it briefly, like mixing the state and Hayward model looks more ideal. Just like thinking about kids and using to a hotel and just
238 even staying for
62. I think it's right. Just from like so I'm also thinking from like the homeowner.
Yeah.
Like right. If like my condo, mm-hmm. If somebody like if some natural disaster happened,
there was a water leak in the building.
If there's if the water gate got flooded, and then my condo, I rented out my condo. I think we also have to keep in mind like that's just natural causes, right? And so not only am I now having to figure out how to get my water gate condo unflooded, now I have to figure out all this additional money. And I'm the owner, and it's not like, you know, it's happened to me too. So right. Trying to figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they do have insurance for these, like.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an owner too. Like, and yeah. I feel, and I also, you know what I mean? Like, I would.
Different perspective, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm an owner. Like, yeah, that's the first thing I think. It was like, ooh, tighten up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, how could I do that?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like,
it's not somebody else's relocation.
Yeah, at the same time, you're expecting somebody to, like, just, you know, they're paying rent. Like, they're still going to pay rent during this.
So I didn't talk about that. But yes, under everybody's policy, the tenant is still required to pay rent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There is no, the tenant stops paying rent. Mm-hmm. The tenant is still required to pay rent.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, that helps, you know, that means that's, you know, if you do 3 times market rate, that's really only 2 times because they're paying the rent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
I know, lots of things to think about.
that's a huge difference, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how does the money get paid? So Oakland and San Mateo, they require that the payment of actual costs is paid 10 days prior to vacancy or 5 days within the date of request.
Mm-hmm.
So I think under those cities, you have to fill something out, identify what the estimated costs are, and then they pay it based on, you know, whatever somebody's saying is that they're staying and what, I don't know how they figure out food. Theirs seems complicated to me, I'll just say that. The fixed cost method, which I think is where we'd prefer to go. San Francisco says 4 days prior to vacancy or 5 days within request of the funds from the tenant. Richmond says the landlord has to pay the tenant 50% of the fixed cost 3 days prior to vacating the unit, and then the remaining 50% gets paid to the tenant 3 days after they vacate the unit. Concord and Hayward say that they have to pay whatever the payment amount is upon the tenant leaving the unit. Alameda requires the payment to be made on a weekly basis. And Berkeley says that the landlord must pay within 10 days of request from the tenant. The state says that it has to be paid within 10 days of receiving the notice to vacate. However, if the notice to vacate is less than 10 days, you have to make the payment immediately.
Mm-hmm.
That is
fair.
Okay, what if this happens and the landlord just doesn't have the means to pay this?
Next slide.
Yeah. The city can like cover that.
So, what enforcement requirements are out there? So, again, I'll go to the bottom. Under the state ordinance, the city may advance the benefit and recover from the owner what they paid the tenant plus a 50% penalty fee. That is in the state law.
What?
Capped at $10,000. In addition, they can also charge them administrative costs and place a lien on the property related to the amount of money that they've paid if the landlord does not reimburse the city.
So basically, I'm filing bankruptcy, you know?
That's what the state law says. And remember, the state law is only issued if there was a government order deeming your unit uninhabitable. Mm-hmm. Not because you've got to do repairs or something else. Only a government order.
Mm-hmm. And can't we put in, again, stipulations around, like, single homeowners versus larger...
That could become an exception. Like, so there could be exceptions.
Where the standard is still held in place for the average larger company that can afford to do it versus, like, a homeowner where it's going to make them go into foreclosure. I feel like it's a... Like,
one of the things that Emily and I found, we went back and watched the old city council meetings from when they adopted the tenant protection ordinance from 2015 and 16. The reason they created the distinction for relocation payments for small and large landlords was exactly for that reason. Because single homeowners came and complained that they could not afford to make this, that this was their investment, this was their long-term retirement, and they would not have the means, which is why they made that distinction of, okay, small landlord, you pay 1 month, large landlord, you pay 5 times. That's the reason that they did that. And yes, we absolutely could create some kind of layering or exclusion. Maybe there's some units that are excluded.
If they're low income, if the homeowner is low income, things like
that. City of Oakland, and it's not on here, so let's go. City of Oakland can bill the property owner for reimbursement and place a lien on the property if that lien goes unpaid. City of Oakland also has a small landlord and what do they call it? Small landlord and low income landlord loan fund, in which if the landlord is determined to be of a certain income level and or has only a small number of properties, there's a loan program that they can apply for to the city in order to get the funds to pay the relocation assistance. And then it's just a loan that they provided to the homeowner or to the landlord that they gets paid back over time.
And that's actually like they actually have that, or is that like we have 10 that we can do and there's like 20 people that need it? Like,
I don't know that part of it. Okay. It's on their website. That's all I know.
Well, there's a lot of things on their website. But okay.
So you're saying that's kind of like an alternative to the city stepping in, making the payment, and then getting recompense from the landlord?
Yeah, they created the small loan program to address.
It's a loan directly to the landlord.
Yes. The landlord has to apply for it, mm-hmm. Yes. So Alameda may issue payment. However, they will only pay a maximum of 14 days if funding is available. And if the landlord fails to do so, the landlord must reimburse the city within 3 days. And the city may issue administrative citations, fines, and take legal action if the landlord fails to issue payment. Berkeley, the city can bill the owner plus administrative fees. The landlord must repay within 30 days. The city can issue a special assessment lien and an administrative lien if the landlord fails to do so. So there are different ways that we can look at it, but the state gives us the ability to say if we do step in and make the payment, not only can we recover payment, we can recover a 50% penalty fee. They've already given us the authority to do that. But again, up to $10,000. Your penalty fee can't exceed $10,000. And remember, a lot of this, there's so many different reasons somebody could have to be temporarily relocated. So we have to think about both situations. It could be something as simple as there was a flood, right? And the bathroom is, you know, you have to have a working bathroom, right? And so maybe that's something that takes 3 days. Like, and it may not be this huge expense, depending upon how we determine our payment schedule. But then maybe it is a relocation where it's going to take, you know, 45 days for something to get fixed. Mm-hmm. We've got to think about both sides of the equation in developing the policy.
Did you were you able to find any data on this? Like, how often is this happening? And like, is it you like what's the distribution? Is it usually for like 3 days, or is it usually for like 30, you know what I mean? Like, do we have any data to show the scale?
I don't, but maybe that's something we can try to do is interview some of the cities and talk to them and see if they have data. I don't, but no. There's no data report that was issued from any of the cities. Actually, the city of Alameda does issue a report, and I don't recall how many temporary relocation issues they have to deal with. But we can look at that, and next time we bring it back, we'll try to have that with us.
I'm guessing it's probably more common than we might suspect. I think
it's fairly common for people that hadn't spoken to.
Yeah.
So those are different ways that the city could step in and issue payment if the landlord fails to do so. I thought it was also interesting. Richmond requires that the landlord provide verification of payment to the tenant to them. Berkeley, Alameda, and Richmond also have provide notification forms that standard template forms for the landlord and the tenant. So when these situations happen, explaining the rights, the rules, mm-hmm. It's stuff that they have to fill out. And so I just wanted to identify that also as an administrative thing. So if we do, requiring verification of payment means that something's coming back to staff person to review, to analyze, I don't know, to do something with. I think providing forms is something that is low hanging administrative cost, unless it's a requirement that those forms come back to the city, verification of issuance or, copies of them come back so that we could then track data. But then there is an administrative cost to that. And then, of course, if we decide that we want to be able to step in, not everybody, only those three cities have it where they'll step in and make the payment under certain circumstances. The other cities don't. It's between the landlord and the tenant.
And I feel like those are the cities that surround us, though. And it seems like
they're also good large cities.
Value.
Also very large cities. And I would estimate, to be honest, of all of the cities probably would have way more cases of temporary relocation than we probably ever would here.
Mm-hmm.
Since I've been with the city, I think I have only seen one, maybe two government orders related to uninhabitability.
Really? Okay.
And those two both happened this year.
Yeah.
Well, now there's a code enforcement person.
We've only had a code enforcement person for the past 2 or 3 years, right?
So it wouldn't have happened before this.
Yeah.
Since the city seems to be considering to get more involved here, so there was some talk before about, okay, you could go to a nearby city, go wherever you want, but maybe if the city is going to get more involved, would it be possible to explore negotiating some sort of deals with hotels within Emeryville, the city, if especially the city's going to get involved, then we're going to sort of guarantee that if it's happening within Emeryville, they would go to an Emeryville hotel and get a discounted rate or mm-hmm. something like
and
that.
It's nice to put the money back like that out.
And it gets more mm-hmm. business for the hotels
mm-hmm.
in the city as well.
I like that thought. Yeah, that's something. Yeah, I don't know that we can, but I like the thought. I like the creativity. Yes, and the fact that the money, you're right, does come back into the city.
Right.
We get tax revenue. Yeah, I mean that's something. Yeah, we can definitely look into.
So, can I ask a question? Yeah. How did those do you know how those places that were people had to relocate? How did they handle it? Since there were no regulations or anything around it, was it poorly? It looks like it was.
I think there were, without trying to get too much into the case, I think there just was not, there's not a policy. And the policy actually reverts to eviction. That's the policy that had to be followed. So the paying of the 5 times the rent, I think was a challenge. Because for the landlord,
They had to pay 5 times the rent?
Because under our current ordinance, it's looked at as an eviction and it's permanent relocation payment.
So did the owner have that? I mean, probably not.
So it gets into that part of, we don't get involved. So the city has a regulation, but as to whether or not something happens, if the landlord fails to do it, our ordinance gives the tenant a right to sue the landlord to get the money back. But we don't engage in that part. Now, we do provide the assistance through ECHO and the coordination of what are the rights and what are you eligible for. But beyond that, what actually ends up happening, we don't negotiate or participate in that component.
Which I think city involvement would help, because I think in some of those cases, even going through it in a civil matter could take a year to see any of the, that. And then the person, that's what leads to homelessness and people being displaced.
It could lead to homelessness on both parts. If the person comes, and if the landlord becomes a bankruptcy over this, you know.
Mm-hmm. Who is the person who gives the tenant their rights of what they can and can't pursue?
So there's a notice. So even right now, when we issue a code enforcement notice, if there is a requirement to vacate the unit, there is some information in there in regards to contacting ECHO so that ECHO can explain your rights. That's what's currently in our ordinance. But in developing whatever this will be, we will include notification requirements in regards to what notification has to be provided to the tenant, what the language is. We need to determine whether or not there's a requirement that it be provided in multiple languages. Mm-hmm. Some cities do that. And then, like, what the step-by-step process is, whether...
So this ECHO information is included in what information from the code enforcer?
If there's a government code, if there's a government order that the unit is uninhabitable, they do put in that reference information, referring them back to ECHO. And then ECHO will reach out to them, because I'll notify them, and they'll then contact the tenant and contact the landlord to make sure that they both understand. Now, that's under the eviction side.
Yeah.
We will definitely develop a process here as well. And that's one of the things that we're also working on, is what that workflow looks like, even from the code enforcement component, because housing and code enforcement are two different divisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if code enforcement is issuing a notice, like, there needs to be communication back to our office. Who's contacting ECHO? Like, those are the things that we all need to coordinate and figure out who's doing what going forward.
Yeah.
But when you initially move in your lease, are you supposed to have information about your
kind of rights and stuff?
Yeah. And any
some jurisdictions do require that. Some of them, you only get the rights if the situation occurs. And so that's a decision that we can make as to whether or not every time a lease is renewed, every time, or is it every time that the tenant's lease renews? Is it just upon initial occupancy? Is it just upon when the situation happens? Those are decisions that we can make.
And so right now, what is it?
Well, it's nothing, because we don't have the policy. These are things we're going to need to think about.
So the current what is that? The agreement? What is that called? Landlord ordinance thing?
The eviction side, they're required to give notification when you enter into your lease. And then they're also required to give that notification when you get the 3-day notice.
And that is a 3-day notice.
To evict.
To evict, which has the tenant's rights? Sorry.
They're required to attach a copy of the requirements written in our ordinance, what the notification requirements are. Actually, the state also has those same notification requirements.
Okay.
So another thing to take into consideration is are these the kind of things that a homeowner's policy property owner's policy would cover? Like,
I don't know.
Or are they not? Because if they are, then, and the insurance is going to cover it, then I would consider being like more liberal with whatever we award the tenant. But like if it's not, this is coming out of the owner's pocket, especially if they're a small landlord, you know, that would change how I would view things.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
Yeah.
Insurance in California has been a bit wonky.
Well, I wonder if it's covered under the renter's insurance at all as well. And like, do the small homeowners require their tenants to carry renter's insurance, and what is that? Are there any requirements? Like for my landlord, he requires us to have renter's insurance, and it needs to be like a certain amount and like that type of thing.
But I think that just covers like your property. Like, it doesn't actually cover like structural, like big repairs, you know, and you're moving out and your expenses and all that, unless it's like a fire, and then it would cover all that, you know. But if it's like, yeah, if it's like a repair, like all of a sudden there was a massive problem with your pipes, like poop coming down your pipes, like you said, you know, then
that was a major health and safety. I was like, oh my gosh, what is going on?
And that's not necessarily something that's covered by insurance, because insurance, that's a home repair, you know. Maybe there's a homeowner's warranty or something on the house, but like probably not for a house that has that bad of,
which is why I think we'll need to determine the trigger and defining what are the kind of things that would then trigger a landlord to make these kind of relocation payments. That's what we'll need to
make. If it was replacing flooring, for example, could we make it as detailed as to like it has to be 50% of the unit square footage or something like that? Like it can be that detailed, or is that,
we can. The question is, do we want to get into all those kind of little things versus keeping it more high level? Because then you're going to get into, well, who's determining the 50%? You know what I'm saying? Like the more layers of detail you have, then who's determining that?
This is obviously only cases where it's been determined that the tenant is not the cause of the
tenant is not the cause. And so let me go back here, because I think that's why the trigger right here so important. If we're only talking about like a government order, if a landlord has allowed their unit to get to a point that a government has to come in and say it's uninhabitable, then you might not be a really good landlord.
Right.
However, so like that's the, you know, high end. Like this shouldn't be for, this is not for small things. These are like for really big issues, right? But if you open it up to be for repairs, now we got all these nuances and decisions that we're going to have to make. It gives more coverage for the tenant, but it also creates a whole lot more decision making, potential administrative responsibility. Like we're gonna have to be very explicit if we try to go down that pathway.
We kind of have to go down that pathway. Like, let's say there's something wrong with the plumbing and the water's gonna be off for 2 weeks. Like, you know, like that's a repair. That's the government, not the government coming in. But I know this lady that like literally that's what her house is. And she lives there. She owns it. So So she's taking bathrooms in the sink. I mean, taking baths in the sink. You know, I'm going over to her neighbor's to go to the bathroom because she has plumbing problems. But, like, if that kind of thing happens and there's no, like, official, like, code violation or government order, then I think that kind of thing would definitely fall.
Well, if there wasn't a working bathroom, then somebody should call code compliance, because that should be a health and safety code violation. You have to have a working bathroom.
Right, but if it doesn't get to that point, if the landlord's like, okay, I'm going to fix this before you have to call the code people, like, I'm going to fix this, but that means you can't have water for 2 weeks, you know? That's when I think that it should include repairs, right? If it affects like whether or not you can actually live there, you know.
Like, and the other question is, you know, I think going back to what's in the lease agreement is going to be important, because landlords also have a responsibility of providing a safe place that has certain things in it. So at the point that they're not providing that, there is some responsibility that the landlord has separate from whatever a city creates, and whether or not the landlord actually complies or does what it needs to is different. But there is some legal coverage within the confines of however that lease was written that should provide protection back to the tenant of the landlord providing a safe and habitable place, whether or not a city comes in and says, oh, there's an issue here.
And this essentially is still like a landlord is, it's a business, you know, if you have to have a business license, right?
Yes, they are supposed to have
a business. It is a business, and with all business, there's going to be some risk, you know. Is there Go ahead. This is kind of off. Is there a part in this where we would incorporate event and timeline to establish whether it is what you're talking about? If the tenant doesn't know that, like, say they didn't read the lease and they
they needed to fix something, and it took 20 days to fix it. But then it broke again, and then it took another 10 days, and then something else happened with the same thing. And then it kind of went, branched out, and now this person is like, doesn't want to even deal with it anymore. So
most of these policy all require consecutive nights. Mm-hmm. So the point that the tenant comes back in, then it ends. And then if there's another time they go back out, then you start over. They're all about consecutive nights. And I'm sorry, I went back forward, but let me get back to where we were. And go ahead.
Well, one quick thing. I do think it is interesting because we have days on there, but you were talking in terms of nights, and hotels are in terms of nights. Mm-hmm. I kind of do feel like the threshold and things should be counted maybe as nights rather than days. I don't know.
No, it's intended to be the same. Sorry. It's intended to be the same. Yeah, sorry.
No,
but, you're right. They do say night, but I wrote days.
Okay. The other thing is on the insurance piece, it is an interesting question, like whether like renter's insurance or some other insurance can cover some of this, because if the landlord ends up paying, but it's something that could be covered by insurance, I don't know. That is a kind of a question. Like,
might be something we need to.
I think insurance is like generally they will investigate like what happened and who was at fault. Like whether the tenant was at fault because they knew there was a problem and they left their things to be impacted anyways, or they weren't aware and it was landlord neglecting to fix, like bring it up to a space where their things weren't getting damaged or stuff like that. I think it matters. Like insurance is going to research everything. So they're going to figure out who is at fault and whether it's going to be the landlord's insurance or the renter's insurance. Also, renter's insurance, you take a hit. So it's like some renters don't want to, if it's not really their responsibility to maintain the house and there's like a leak or something, and then you have to take that against your insurance, like your premiums or prices can also go up if you're having to do that instead of.
Yeah.
And none of their policy, nobody else's policy talks about whether or not there was insurance coverage or not. It's they're all completely silent on it.
It's a shame, because I feel like there could be some cases where, like, you know, it's possible that someone might get the pay, the temporary assistance paid, you know, by the landlord, and then maybe they're also getting insurance.
I'm sure that insurance companies have policies on you know, how much they're used to having to deal with that, probably.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
I'd be curious, like, what their policies are, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and then everybody's renter's insurance is going to be different.
Sure.
So how do we, you know, what if you didn't have renter's insurance? And what if you did, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question was asked earlier about what happens if displacement lasts longer than whatever that initial timeline is or whatever our maximum days is. So Alameda in Richmond, they require the landlord to pay rent differential once it goes beyond 60 days, because 60 days was their threshold. So rent differential is whatever the fair market rent is minus what the tenant has actually paid. Now the landlord has to provide that amount also to the tenant. I will say this. I talked about this with Chad today. It makes the assumption that the tenant's rent is less than fair market rent. I don't know what. And so if that's not the case, then there's no additional payment.
It's not the other way, right?
It's a weird kind of thing, but it's making the assumption, because I think typically, you know, the assumption is that tenants' rent is less, but that's not always the case. And when it's not, you don't get anything. If it goes beyond the, there's no additional payment that you get. Concord says the temporary relocation payment just continues. The policy, you know, you go beyond whatever that time frame is, it still happens, but now they're issuing payment to you every week. Mm-hmm. San Francisco says that it also continues. San Francisco has a different policy. They have two temporary relocation policies, and within their policy, they have three tiers. So this is just talking about for repair, rehab, capital improvement type of things. And this is if you're going from the 30 days to their second tier, which is called 60 days. But you continue getting the payment, but the landlord has to pay you that money in no less than 2-day increments. So they can give it to you on the weekly basis, they can give it to you on a monthly basis, but at a minimum, they've got to give you 2 days or 2 nights every single time.
That's a nightmare. Do I need it every other day?
Oakland says after the 60 days, you convert to permanent relocation payment. So like we have in the eviction where it's five times or one, you automatically convert.
In addition to?
Whatever you've already received, once you go beyond that, now you get the permanent relocation payment.
So you get both.
After 60 days, you get the permanent.
Which is higher.
Which is higher.
Okay. Because like what I'm saying is like, do they take out what they paid for 60?
No.
Like if you get 15,000, do they take out the 4,000 you've got in those 2 months?
No.
That's in addition to. That makes sense. I was going to say.
Yes. Yeah, there's no, whatever you received prior to that on all of these, it doesn't count towards us. Like it is, that payment is done and settled, and now we're in a new phase. Yeah.
But that's a good question, though, because like if it ends up being more than 60 days and it's basically turns out to be a permanent relocation, and you are only being recompensed at a lower rate for the first 60 days, but then does retroactively, it is actually a permanent relocation, right?
That is a good point and something that I think I didn't look into as much, but yes, some of them do actually distinguish temporary from permanent and say if it's going to be work that takes longer than X days, you're automatically classified as permanent.
Right.
Some of them do that.
Yeah.
I didn't go back and we didn't do that in our analysis, but we can go back again and try to see how many of them do that distinction. I think the idea for most of them is that it's temporary if it's only 30 days. Mm-hmm. Anything beyond 30 days really is permanent from the way a lot of their ordinances are written.
I guess I'm saying it kind of creates an incentive for a landlord to say, oh, it's going to be less than 30 days.
It could, unless you make it punitive to go beyond
that's true.
That time.
That's true. Right. Yeah.
That's the way we could try to counteract that. So Hayward says if it goes longer than 30 days under all scenarios, you get 3 times the fair market rent. Not prorated per day, 3 times the fair market rent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Alameda says that after 60 days, the tenant may terminate tenancy. And then the landlord has to provide a permanent relocation payment. So they do their threshold at 60. If the tenant decides, you know what, I want to terminate my tenancy anyway. I found somewhere else. I'm good going. And now the landlord has to give them permanent relocation payment.
I like that one.
So it's like Oakland, but with the tenant's say.
It's the tenant's choice to terminate or not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They might really want to move back to that location.
Yeah, they might love their house. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it also determines what kind of unit, like if they have a regular unit, if they work from home, if they have business in there, if they.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that it should be the tenant or the landlord. They should just reevaluate at 60 days. I don't think that the landlord may be like, this is going to take 6 months. It's cheaper just to pay them out. Well, I don't know if it would be.
No. And they're still paying rent this whole time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, but when you raise a good issue, like, I mean, what about the park units, right? Like, I mean, if you have a business in there, the kind of impact of relocation is different, right? Insurance is different. And we have a lot of live work units in Everyville.
And would it be the fair market rate of a live work space?
There is no fair market rate for live work. There is not. And live work is, I don't know that they're excluded.
Okay.
So we'll need to go back and really dive into what types of units are excluded.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, do you recall if anybody had, I don't think anybody has a policy related to relocation with live work. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is because technically live work is considered commercial property.
Mm. Doesn't that have to do with the
so when relocation for a business is very different than relocation for a residence.
But doesn't that have to do with the permit of
occupancy?
The permit in Emeryville, is there commercial?
The permit of occupancy for that unit, if the landlord knows it's a live-work unit, then it's a live-work unit. It's not a commercial unit.
Yeah, but the permit of occupancy actually is commercial. You have to have a business license. Like, there are certain requirements.
No, yeah, you do. But the landlord knows you're living there, then he knows you're living there.
There's also a requirement to live there as well, to be a resident.
There is.
Yeah.
But I think there is how we live, and then there is zoning code.
Right.
Those two things don't necessarily align. For the live-work units, and I'm not prepared to talk about live-work under this because nobody, that doesn't come up in any research, mm-hmm. like how this applies to live-work. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a lot of information to provide or references, but
I will say that I know personally of multiple cases
mm-hmm.
where this has affected live-work mm-hmm. units within Emeryville.
Do you know what they've done?
I'm not going to go into the details, but it does happen.
Because I think on a commercial side, there is relocation requirements on commercial. Right. That are different than, that's what I'm saying, it's different than residential. So, yeah, right. I think we would need to.
It'd be different. It'd be a different.
We need to do a whole lot of research to figure out what happens in live work situations.
Right.
And that might be a special carve out that we need to think about what the policy is.
How many live work spaces are there in Emeryville?
I don't know off the top of my head. I know planning did look into it. I don't recall what the number is. But can you write that down? I know we pulled it.
Yeah, she was doing research on that.
She pulled it, but I don't know what the number is. But I can, tomorrow, I'll ask her and I'll email it out to everybody.
Like, if the percentage is high, it might be worth.
It's not high. Hmm. I want to say that I think it's less than 500 units in Emeryville.
City.
Mm-hmm.
How many units are there in Emeryville, though? The 500 units seems like a lot.
So we have 6,000 or 7,000?
I think it's 10,000.
Because
you guys have about
30,000. 7,000
is
kind of a lot.
The thing, though, with live work is that live work is generally converted from industrial uses, mm-hmm. right? And those are exactly the kinds of cases where habitability issues can occur.
Right. Yeah. I think it's definitely worth us trying to figure out, is there a policy that we need to have related to that? Yeah.
They have to look at more cities when you look at neighboring cities.
So yeah.
Maybe you just look at
cities. Yeah.
Cities
that definitely have more live work and see if they have
temporary displacement or a business eviction replacement thing. I feel like that would be good to know.
So this is just for thought today, and we went a little longer than I thought. I thought it was a short meeting today. But I know this is a lot. So, I mean, you guys have kind of talked about it, but are there any things that jump out to you in regards to what kind of trigger you guys are thinking that you have interest in? So, like, again, state requirement is a government code. Most people use a government code compliance, health and safety. Are you guys interested in us doing the expansion, or do you think it probably is safest for us just to stick with those as to what would trigger a relocation?
I like the most triggered, but I think there's room to add just based off of kind of what you're saying about, like, not having a sink, but I guess that's part of coded.
That could be health and safety. So maybe what we need, so if we do with that, we need to really look into how we would define health and safety. And what do you guys think about doing that? If we use the most triggered and then really come up with what are those health and safety issues that would qualify?
Well, first, the terms that were on the other page, were those all the terms used in the nearby cities?
Yes,
those were all the terms.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I kind of liked Hayward's, but I feel like I would want to know what they meant because they did seem like they kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And also, too, what types of buildings are in Hayward? Is it, or is Emeryville more like blah, blah, blah than da, da, da? So, you know, if you
don't know that we're like, to be honest, every time I think about us, like trying to find, like, trying to find comparable cities is the hardest thing for us to do.
Yeah.
Because we're not like anybody else. We have a super high rental population. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of condominiums mm-hmm. that were built, you know, in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. We don't have a lot of single family homes. Mm-hmm. We're just not like any other city.
Yeah. What is, does anybody know approximately what the 9-to-5 commute people number is here? People number. I know, like the people that just work here, as opposed to
my understanding, and this is probably a little old, that we have 20,000 people who work in Emeryville, and we are around 12,000 to 13,000 people who live in Emeryville. We have a high jobs to resident ratio where people come into Emeryville mm-hmm. to work, that people actually spend the night living in Emeryville.
That is, there is census data for that. That is,
I think that number, that it's a little old, but that's what I recall.
I think it's 40 something.
I think for the most used trigger one, too, I think, Valerie, your point about the condo community is a big one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious to see if there is something that can be included that reflects some of the concern that, that opens another can of worms of HOAs and like all those things, but I'm wondering if something along those lines would be worth considering. And then one of the cities had natural.
Yeah, they were the only city. I think that was Hayward.
Is that not in government? Is that not covered in?
No, a lot of them explicitly exclude natural disasters mm-hmm. because I think there's the thought is that there's a whole other process when a natural disaster happens.
Okay.
So they don't consider a natural disaster as a temporary relocation. Like, that probably really is permanent.
Okay.
So it was interesting to me that Hayward had that.
Okay.
So what about number two on the displacement threshold? I think we kind of talked about that 30 days, and we need to figure out, like, if you displace somebody for longer than 60 days, are you creating permanent residency? Legally, we need to figure that out. Are we creating a problem? But do you guys think the 30 days is reasonable for a temporary relocation? Should it be something else?
I think it should be 60 personally, but
I don't need one. It's nice where it gives the tenant a say whether they even want to come back. Because sometimes being temporarily displaced, it's like, well, now you've, you know, reacclimated to this new environment. Mm-hmm. You've moved all your stuff.
That's
you've
a good paid
point. A deposit. You've moved your utilities. Still paying the rent on this place. It's like, okay, well, you don't want to keep uprooting mm-hmm. yourself. So I feel like the 60 days is fairly, I don't know, I feel like 2 months is a long time to not be in your home, and it's worth revisiting.
Mm-hmm. I'm hearing two of you guys like 60 days.
Can you explain a little bit? I didn't quite grasp the 30-day, what was it, tenancy establishment? I didn't quite. What's the concern with
that? Like at a hotel, you can't stay at a hotel longer than 30 days because you're establishing tenancy.
Yeah, that's true.
So that was just a point Chad brought up to me when we were talking through this, that anything beyond 30 days, you can't be at a hotel.
You actually can't be. That's why it's 29 days.
That's more. Right.
Well, yeah. I wonder if we could do like a 30.
Because then you're requiring them to move to another unit. Which again, and you're not repaying moving cost again. So I think, and I was like, oh, I didn't think about that. So I don't know how these others address that issue.
Yeah.
So even in a short-term rental, I don't know if you could do that.
I mean, you can leave for a day and come back and it resets, but then
where's all your stuff go?
But then all your stuff. Yeah.
I'm very confident that's what it is. You have to leave for a day and come back.
Yeah.
You do like a 29 or 30 day, and then like basically blend the Alameda and the other one where it's like 30 days, and then the tenant can say like, we're, this isn't moving anywhere, and the landlord can say this is much longer, like they have a projected plan, and then it would move into permanent tenancy.
The 60 days versus permanent tenancy versus the permanent relocation at 30 days.
I was like with the I just feel like it's important to have the tenant say whether they actually want to come back or not. Some people mm-hmm. are really attached to their home and they would wait 90 days,
I got you,
whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And some people are like, this is drastically impacting my health and wellness mm-hmm. and just need to yeah. move on. And,
yeah. I mean, but I think the landlord should have a say,
that's
too.
That's the one who should be, that's what I think, too.
I mean, the landlord's, like, seeing, like, this is going to take 6 months or yeah. going to take, like, this is not, I can't, like, if the landlord's like, I don't have any money to fix the rest of this, like, and they have to, like, it's 60 days, they're like, you know, they.
Well, that's when they would go to the no-fault eviction.
Right, but still, right. even that would be, could be.
And then you're triggering the either the 1 month or the 5 months of rent.
Right. Even that could be cheaper than them doing all these repairs, you know, it depends on what's wrong with the building.
Yeah, that's true.
I think both of them should have a say in 60 days.
And you're right, and they work together, because I understand that you think the tenant should have a say, but she's right. I mean, if the landlord knows it's going to take 3 to 4 months to fix this.
Yeah.
They need to make a decision depending upon what policy we have in place. But ultimately, it might be that, no, it's you've got to do the no-fault eviction.
Yeah.
But even under the no-fault eviction, if it's about repair, the tenant return. Still has the right to return. Yes. That doesn't go away.
That's what I was thinking.
Even if it's substantial rehab, mm-hmm. the tenant still automatically gets that right to return.
I see.
But what they are getting is that upfront relocation payment.
Okay.
From day one.
That makes sense.
Versus I put you somewhere for a short period of time. I mean, I think, again, the thing is not to address an entire remodel. If it's a remodel, no, yeah. you need to do a no-fault eviction,
yeah.
pay the tenant, mm-hmm. and then the tenant has the right to come back at the previous rental rate okay. when the work is done.
I didn't understand.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with the 60 days, except for the fact that there's already a rule in the books that says you can't stay in a hotel for more than 29 days. And like,
what book?
It's a law.
It's a tenancy law. Right. That's why hotels can't.
I recently ran into this myself, okay. right? And the hotel was like, no, you can't extend your stay.
Yeah, right.
I think 90 days is valid, or 29.
Because otherwise, like, you're displaced twice. Mm-hmm. Right. And like I
think you also establish tenancy. Let's say you were renting from somebody else. You establish tenancy with them. Now all your tenant, you've established tenant rights. If you're staying somewhere longer than 30 days.
Can a landlord supersede that 30 day thing and say, no, I'm just going to pay for them to stay another 30 days?
No. What if the repairs aren't done? You need 35 days. I mean, that's just a that's life. Like sometimes you have a contractor that's sick for 2 weeks and it's going to take an extra little bit of time. Like at that point, like, I'm sorry, but at 30 days, like the tenant needs to like move to another hotel or, you know, stay somewhere else for a night or do what they have to do. Mm-hmm. Like it's going to be an inconvenience to everybody. Right. This has to happen. You know, it's like one inconvenience for the tenant. We have to baby the tenant like so much. Like,
well, the tenant mm-hmm. doesn't have a business responsibility. A landlord does have that responsibility to ensure the space for them. So if the tenant actually, in my opinion, shouldn't be taking the brunt of the, I don't think it's considered babying them to provide them with.
They're getting plenty of compensation, three times the rent. If they're getting plenty of compensation and they're in the hotel for 30 days and they find out from the contractor it's going to be another 7 days, like, you know, like that, there's like no way around that, you know, there's no way, there's nothing that we can, you know, that's just fact.
So maybe it doesn't go straight to permanent relocation, but something should happen.
Like San Francisco having those tiers.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they have a 30, 60, 90, or theirs is the 20, and then they do a 60, and then there's a 90 day. They call it short term, moderate, long term. It's weird.
And keep in mind,
between them,
20, 60, 90.
No, I mean, like, first is just the days. Like, what's the.
I didn't look into all those types of differences. Most of the policy is just related to the 20 days.
Mm-hmm. Like it sounds glamorous to live in a hotel.
It's not.
But it's not. You have like much less space than you did, you know, in your apartment.
And laundry and cooking. Like it's a huge
nightmare.
Yeah.
And you're all on top of each other. It's
even a total nightmare. If you have to have repairs done at your home and have to go somewhere else, it's not so.
Yeah.
But I do want us to remember. This is about temporary. So a lot of these conversations is about trying for us all to get on the same page is
right.
What do we really consider as temporary?
Mm-hmm.
And I think We're somewhere between the 30 and 60.
Yeah.
But I think we need to do some more research to understand that trigger.
Yeah.
And we'll talk to some of the other cities that go beyond 60 days, that go beyond the 30 days, see how they address it. Maybe it is that the tenant has to move somewhere else. And it just is what it is. I don't know. But we'll come back to that.
Maybe compensation can be written in for them having to move it there or something.
You like all moving costs.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, but not baby and the tenant. I mean, just they can, they're adults. They can figure out how to move to another hotel if they have to. Like, they can be compensated to do that.
That might be the way to address it.
Yeah.
What should the payment standard cover? So Hayward just did 3 times and the tenant doesn't, they determine whatever they're using their money for, right? But the ones that did the per diem, some of them, they all covered hotel and meals, but some of them covered other things like laundry, pets. There's a different rate for a dog versus a cat. Maybe if we figure out in this live work, maybe there also is, if you have a home-based business, there's a rate for that. I don't know. Okay. But, you know, what are the things that you guys are thinking should definitely be covered? And then what would be nice to be covered?
This is not permanent. These are just throwing out ideas, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And this is why we're just discussion topic, so that we can start writing and thinking about
covered.
What it will look like.
Well, you do have, whatever your least habitability things are, which is a bed, a kitchen, a working bathroom, your pet, your work, and if you need like certain whatever things you need, some people need certain kinds of air, some people need certain kinds of things, you know, for whatever they need, it has to you have to be able to just live the way you were in there, but in a safe way. Everybody needs a bed. Everybody needs to have their bed taken care of. Everybody needs a plumbing, a kitchen if they need to cook, or if they're saying no, they don't. Just like comparable.
So the base, the floor should be just maintaining the status quo. So what they have.
Yes.
Right,
but we're talking about what the payment standard is. What are we paying them for?
Well,
are we paying them just for their nightly rate? Are we paying them for the nightly rate plus meals? Are we paying them for anything else? Or are we just coming up with a flat figure? And how they choose to use that flat figure is how they choose to use it. That's what Hayward does. It's the 3 times of the fair market rate.
Yeah.
Plus moving costs, but they don't give another an allowance for pets. There's no additional allowance for meals. This is what we're doing instead of that per diem rate.
Yeah,
but there should that, be
that minimizes your choices though, because you could be able to stay with somebody for 10 days and then not stay with them for another 10 days. So that bumps up whatever you decided that you needed for the 30 days that you're getting whatever for, or 20 days that you're getting whatever one you choose. But your situation has totally changed from now I have to go get a hotel and house the pet because the hotel closest to my work doesn't allow pets. So that's another expense. Like, it's
but
crazy.
If you're staying with a friend for 10 of the days,
you're still getting the payment
for that money. Like, you're getting 3 times the rent no matter what.
I like Hayward's 3 times fair market rate.
I do too. Well, I like that one.
I do think, but I also like the moving.
Plus moving costs.
Moving costs are
storage.
Well, so that's the thing. I think it depends on the trigger, right? Yeah. So sometimes you need to move all your furniture and sometimes you don't, right?
That's absolutely correct.
So in some cases you do need storage. And in some cases you might not, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there should be some variability. It's not one size fits all, right?
But I do think if it's causing you to move, like, you will have to move
all of your stuff.
Certain things. Like if the problem is to the point where you're having to temporarily relocate, I'm guessing it would impact like your thing, like your room, mm-hmm. things that you need. And
I think it does depend on what's happening. I mean, I know we've had cases where somebody's bathroom wasn't working. They had to temporarily relocate. Now, do they need to move their things out of the unit? No.
Right.
But they needed somewhere to stay for the 5 days that the plumber was going to be having to have access to the unit.
Yeah.
Where, but then there also has been a case where someone's house was infested with mold. They had to completely come out. Their things needed to be removed from the property. There's a different standard, like,
yeah,
we got to think about it both ways. Mm-hmm. And then I think even in that case, the question becomes, if the work is going to take longer than X number of days, is it temporary or not?
Mm-hmm. So if it becomes permanent, maybe then you would need a moving.
Right, depending upon whether or not you actually have to move all your things out, because you may not. Depending upon what it is, you may not.
That's a really good point. So maybe you could structure it in a way, because I was thinking structure it in a way as if it's health and safety, it's this. If it's major repairs, it's this. If it's da-da-da, it's this. But it's not really that. It's that, do you need to move body and items?
Yeah.
Or do you just need to move body?
Mm-hmm.
That could be an easier way to do it, because sometimes major repairs can cause health and safety problems,
mm-hmm.
or a health and safety
mm-hmm.
can just be that, and then you need your things and you out, but then you could get a major repair that causes a health and safety. Now you have to have your stuff out. Like, it totally goes all on top of each other.
And sometimes it depends, like, how many people are in your household, what type mm-hmm. of people are in your household. Do mm-hmm. your kids play the drums, and now you need to move their drum set because they have practice 3 times a week? Mm-hmm. And it's like,
yeah.
Yes, if it's just a bathroom, but you still have to have your things that flow with your life,
mm-hmm.
I feel like.
You can't have your drum set in a hotel,
though. Which is another problem. Well, I guess I'm in my like, in my mind, I don't even think hotel, because, like, going to a hotel with 2 kids is like, and your cats, and, like, it's not possible. Like, it's not possible at all.
Airbnb.
Well, yeah, I finally got the Airbnb stuff, so I was looking at those prices. What are the prices? They're not cheap. Not in the East Bay. There are longer time period hotels.
Like, for longer, Marriott has a brand, 1,978 for 30 days.
Hotel is way more. Okay, so we still got things to think about, but I this is good information for us to understand kind of what you're thinking.
Number one thing is to find out the definition of those words.
We're gonna have to work on
that. And then what is the scenario with those words? Body stuff? Just body?
Mm-hmm.
Work, or just residential? Like, it's crazy.
Any recommendations or thoughts you guys have on the payment timing as to how quickly should funds be provided to the tenant? I think it was anywhere from 0 days to 10 days.
A week before they have to move, so they can pay for stuff.
I think that does work, except for when it's a government order. Usually, you got to move that day.
Oh, well, if you got to move that day, you got to get paid that day.
I think it's the state's disaster. 10 days or immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But that one seemed reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what about the frequency? So are they paying it all for the number of days that are designated? Or are they only, you know, or is it broken up? Like, I think it was Alameda, the payments come weekly.
I think they should
The landlord's not having to put all that money there at one time.
No, I think it should be weekly.
I don't know, because look, you book a hotel,
mm-hmm.
okay? You book for 7 days, and then you suddenly realize you have to extend. That hotel might not have occupancy. Mm-hmm. You may have to
move. Because they've already booked your room.
Okay, yeah. Right. What if the repairs are going to take 7 days? Like.
Right. That gets into the whole point of the relocation plan, that there is something that identifies how long this is anticipated to take, and then what the estimated total payment will be. Now, how that gets broken out and paid out is what we need to
talk about. I mean, I feel like that if your repair is going to take 30 days and you got to pay for a hotel for 30 days because you don't want to, you know, or Airbnb, you mm-hmm. want to get the Airbnb for 30 days. You at the very minimum need to have that payment. I don't know how that would be determined. Like, Now, that Airbnb wants the money up front.
Yeah.
I was going to be like, half? Okay, now here's the other question, right? So let's say they pay half of it. You're telling them you got to pay half of it up front and then another half after a few days or whatever. How is the rent that they're supposed to pay? How's that factoring in all that? So like if they're moving out for 30 days, right? And we tell them it's three times the rent. So the rent's $6,000, but they're only having to pay you $4,000. So then how much of that do you get up front? I think that keeping in mind that like part of it is gonna be their rent, then if it's only 2/3 of it, they should pay that all up front.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Since it's only 2/3, you know?
I think we need to look into what the exceptions are and if there's a distinction for small landlords versus large.
Yeah.
As to whatever the process may be. Because I think that'll help. Once we think about that, I think that'll help us figure out them.
I do think you need the money up front to book the entire time that you're supposed to be displaced. Mm-hmm. Like the landlord's got to make a reasonable, realistic determination of the amount of time. And then you have to be able to make a plan for that entire period of time up front.
Other thing I'll say is when I mentioned the two code enforcement issues.
Yeah.
Those did not happen in large landlord-owned properties.
Okay.
So when we talk about the ability of somebody to pay, I want us to keep that in mind. That we're seeing it happen more in quadruplexes, triplexes, 12 units or less, not our large corporate
properties. This is where the city
can step in.
Could step in, right?
Should the city step in? Is that a responsibility that you guys think is the city should have funding dedicated to pay for these things?
Small landlords,
for small
absolutely.
Landlords.
Yeah. I do think it's reasonable.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like it's helping.
Or at least some kind of mediation.
I know the city does not want to hear that.
Yeah.
You're voting yes on that.
That's the one thing we can all.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to skip the administrative because I do want us to get to the end because I know that.
There shouldn't be administrative.
Head out. Okay, so we talked about this. All right, so homeless rep. I'm sorry, can I go to the next slide?
Oh, yes.
This is such a big topic.
Okay, so homeless strategy. I just had this on here for discussion because we've never brought it since I've been with the city to the committee. So I did want you guys to know that evidently in 2015, the city did adopt a homeless strategy. It has 5 different components. The first one is to prevent at-risk persons from becoming homeless or returning to homelessness. Second one is to remove barriers to accessing homeless services. Number 3, participate in regional strategies for preventing and reducing homelessness. 4, provide housing services, and 5, ensure safe living conditions for individuals who are experiencing homelessness, as well as those who are residing in the surrounding area.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been our policy since 2015. We haven't made any changes. I don't necessarily know that we need to make changes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple things coming down the line. We may end up having to make some modifications to this, but I don't know quite yet. It's something that's in process. But if we do, we will come back to you guys to talk about it. The city has always contracted with a nonprofit service provider to help us provide these services.
Mm-hmm.
Previously with Berkeley Food and Housing, which is now called Insight Housing, and currently we're with Operation Dignity. We currently have an RFP out on the streets right now looking for a service provider. All of our contracts are always for 3 years, so every 3 years we do it. So we currently have it out. The response to the RFP is due May 22nd. And so what that nonprofit service provider is responsible to do is to perform street outreach 5 days a week and at least 1 weekend a month. They're also required to have at least 1 day a week have 7 to 10 p.m. hours so that they're there in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
They provide housing-focused case management, provide or connect clients with additional supportive service providers and to help facilitate whatever stabilization is needed. That could include things like helping them get their driver's license or apply for Social Security, taking them to the DMV, all kind of different things that they do provide help with. They also assist the city with our encampment resolution and outreach. We have a rapid rehousing program that provides rental assistance and case management over the course of 1 year to those who are prepared and at a point that they can transition from being unhoused into permanent residency. One of the requirements for that is that they have to be working, because while we do provide rental assistance, we pay 100% of that tenant's rent for the first 6 months. And then the last 6 months, it's a tiered. So at month six, then the tenant starts kicking in 25. I think it's at month 8 or 9, they kick in 50% of the rent. So that month 12, they get down to now they're responsible for the entire 100% amount of rent.
Okay. You want to finish?
Oh, no, let's get the last one. And then they also administer an emerging needs fund that we've provided to them to cover immediate needs of people who are out there experiencing homelessness. So we recently have reunited two people with family or friends. We bought bus tickets, train tickets, so that they could go back to their home because that's what they wanted to do. And we only did it because the family was willing to accept them and have them come and live with them. We've also used the money. We had somebody who was homeless that wanted to get CPR certified for a job they were looking for. We paid for the certification. We used the money to buy every year backpacks for those that are out on the street filled with all kinds of supplies. They can provide sandwich bags to the people so they can use the money, deodorant. Somebody has a job interview, we can, you know, help them get things that they need for that. So they have that emerging funds that they can actually use those funds to help with those immediate expenses that are coming up.
How much is that allotted to that?
I think it's about $35,000 we put into that fund. They have to get approval from the city before they spend the money. But yeah, it's like $35,000.
Okay, all right, here we go. First of all, do you guys know what encampment resolution is? What they mean by that?
Sounds like some sort of euphemism.
Encampment resolution, what it might mean, means clearing encampments.
Yes.
That's what it means. So that may assist with encampment resolution and outreach, which is not a great thing for the service provider to do both street outreach and help with the camera resolution, because it gives them a bad reputation with the unhoused.
Well, let me tell you what it is that they do. And I appreciate you making the distinction, because it's written in our scope. Mm-hmm. But really what happens is, so one, we meet with the service provider. We have biweekly meetings. It's a meeting with the service provider. It's our Office of Economic Development and Housing, the police department, and public works. Mm-hmm. So we all meet in the city manager's office. So we all meet every other week and we talk about all the cases that are going on in the city. If there is an area that has been determined that we need to do a clearance on, a good example that you guys might have been aware of is that we had an encampment that had been developing up at the skate park and mm-hmm. where the Planet Fitness was going into. Mm-hmm. And so we had to do an encampment clearance of that area. So I do the posting. There's state laws that require us to post certain information, identifying that the area is going needs to be cleared. Public Works actually goes out and puts it out there. But prior to us posting it, our service provider is communicating with the people in that area every day. They're going out there and telling them they're about to post. By this day, you're gonna have to leave. Do you need me to help you go somewhere? Do you need me to help you get? So every day they're doing that. And then on the actual clearance day, Public Works goes out there. Police is there only to make sure that there's no issues. And then they're also there to also see if there needs to be assistance in helping people who may have not. A lot of times we find that even though they've been notified and they say, yeah, I know, on the day of, they're still there and they're slowly pulling their things together or whatnot. But that's the role that they traditionally play, is just making sure that they've communicated and that they're offering services. Do you need me to help you go somewhere, find somewhere to be?
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds good in theory. I'm not saying anything about Emeryville, but I know in other places that's not what actually happens. But
yes.
Okay. So then this rapid rehousing program, like, do you get access to that through coordinated entry? Or, I mean, how do you gain access to that?
So this is our own rapid rehousing program. Coordinated entry does have one. Part of the reason that cities like us, I think Albany, that a lot of us have created our own, was because the program that's funded through the county through coordinated entry was oversubscribed. Mm-hmm. So we've created our own. We created our own program. It's completely managed by the service provider. So it's if when we get referrals and they come through the Emeryville Unified School District or just from being out in the community, we also have a place where residents can identify if there's somebody who's unhoused and what's going on with that through our C-Click Fix. We'll send the service provider out there when they're doing their assessment. That's how it's determined as to whether or not this is a good candidate to go into a rapid rehousing. And it doesn't necessarily just have to be somebody who's living on the street. We have technically, you know, if you are house hopping, you're living in your car, you are technically defined as unhoused. And so those type of people also could be eligible for rapid rehousing. The biggest challenge we're finding is there has to be some source of income or the ability to make money, because we don't want to set them up for failure of putting them in somewhere when they don't have any way to pay rent or pay utilities. You know, we're covering it for a period. We also pay the deposit. We've also used our merging funds to help buy somebody a bed. So we will try to set them up, but they're doing the case management to determine whether or not this is actually a you're a good candidate for that program.
I was gonna ask what your definition of homeless is, because everybody has their own definition of homeless, but that's good to know that it can be.
We tried to make it much more flexible.
But how would you actually determine whether or not, well, we'll get any, I got, maybe we can ask questions. I got plenty of questions. But, So what agent, so Operation Dignity does all this?
They do all that, yeah. They've been our provider for the last 3 years. I will say I didn't work with our other provider. I started managing this last August. They've been great. I will also say staffing has a lot to do with it. And having the right person who's out there on the street who can connect with the residents really can make or break a program and how things are moving.
Is it a team?
They do have a staff. It's one person who's our street outreach. We're a small city. We don't have a huge homeless population. So we have one person who's out there on the street, but they do have a team of people that they work with. Operation Dignity also provides services in Oakland. And so, like, when that person is out, they have one of their Oakland people step in. That Oakland person also still sits in our meetings. One, because we are such a small city. The other thing we also see is when Oakland and Berkeley clear encampments, they come here.
So is there like a hub where these people can go if they want to connect and they need services?
Yes. There's a housing resource center.
Housing resource center.
They have a bunch of them in Alameda County. They also have street outreach and mobile medical clinics, or they have a social worker on the medical.
In Emeryville specifically?
They do have mobile medical that comes.
We have through the county, they will come.
Yeah.
They have mobile medical that will go throughout different places, and our service provider can also reach out and contact them. Now, the housing resource centers, however, are strategically located throughout the county. We're part of the housing resource center located in Berkeley. So the Berkeley Center feeds services Emeryville, Albany, and Berkeley.
And that's a better housing resource center.
We're called the North County Hub. So, like, we also have coordination meetings with the other jurisdictions. And so we're a part of that North County. So really the three, Albany, Berkeley, and Emeryville coordinate. Sometimes it is quite interesting because most of the time what we are seeing is those that are coming into Emeryville are coming from Oakland, but our connections are to the Berkeley side. But it doesn't matter because we've also met with people, like when they were doing the clearance over here by the hotel next to Target, you know, we were a part of that coordination. The small homes that they did over by back by Target, that's in Oakland. Emeryville actually funded some of those, and so there were direct spaces for Emeryville people to go there. We also provide, we have a contract with St. Vincent de Paul that provides up to 100 beds throughout the year for Emeryville residents. It's available for them. My understanding is they don't get used very often, but it is available for them.
Where is that?
Actually, these days they're booked every night. But I mean, maybe not by Emeryville resident. I mean, Emeryville homeless people. That was my next question. Is So I wasn't. I lived in one of the encampments that was that used to be in Emeryville.
Okay.
I was behind Home Depot for a little while when I was unhoused. But
well, and technically, so that's Oakland.
But one side of the street's Oakland. One side of the street's Emeryville.
Right? Behind the Home Depot was actually is technically, which is also some, yeah. which is why we have to coordinate because a lot of times there is overlap. Yeah. But yeah, no, technically, everything that I've been told is. The back of the building
yeah.
is Emeryville. Mm-hmm. Everything outside the building.
Yeah. And I was behind Target. So I was, was both places. But anyway, ancient history. My question is like, that was my next question about like, where are the homeless people in Emeryville? I'm pretty sure that like a lot of most of the encampments have been cleared.
Most of, so our encampments don't look like Oakland and Berkeley's encampments. No. They really just don't.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time when we're clearing what we're calling an encampment clearance, it is somebody's stuff that is in the public right of way that has been there for a long period of time. And so we're trying to not have it be there. We had somebody had put a gazillion things over near the staircase near the Amtrak. And so like we had to clear that. Never was anybody ever found sleeping there. But we had to put up signs like you can't put all these things here.
It's not really like but they're just like
there used to be encampments. There used to be encampments in Emeryville, but not.
We don't really have them. So we were asked where are they?
Mm-hmm.
One, we've had a lot of our homeless, like when we go out and do the pit count, which is the point in time count.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, right before COVID. I participated. A lot of the homeless we found were living in their cars down at the marina. I will say when we went out this year, the streets were quiet. I don't know what has happened, but finding people on the streets, finding people in their cars, they just were not. We have not been seeing people sleeping in the cars the way they used to. Now, we do still find that, but not at the rates that we were finding it before. But we do have certain areas along the Amtrak underneath the Powell Street Bridge. We have some people who stay over there. There are some people out at the marina.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we know who our people, like I have a listing. We know their names. We know where they are and we know the areas they are. We're not really doing anything, you know, but they tell us every single week, you know, who do they talk to and what services they offered or what are they working on? Are they interested in anything?
Yeah.
They give us that level of detail.
We have some homeless people near Watergate that live across the street, live at the bus stop and live next to the police station. And
yes.
They, okay. So,
one of our names.
And then these funds, these are like the flex funds, mm-hmm. the last ones. So with that being said, with hardly any homeless people, like what
we're not spending all of our money, even on the rapid rehousing, we don't spend the majority of our money. It's allocated out of the city's budget every year to fund these things, but it's not necessarily being spent when there's not necessarily a need. It's one of the things we've talked about, whether or not we need to reduce what's there because our numbers just aren't what they used to be.
I have a theory on where the homeless people are, but.
For the rapid rehousing program, like if one wanted to do that, do they go to the Berkeley place?
No.
How does that even get connected?
When the service provider is communicating with the person, they will have those conversations to determine whether or not
Johnson
that is a right fit.
So
the service provider.
What if it is someone that's couch surfing and they want to access the service?
Oh, that has not.
Oh, where do they even get connected if they're not?
They probably need to reach out to one of the service providers, go to the housing resource center, and then there's coordination.
Is there something different about it?
The people underneath the stairs was a couple. I used to walk by every morning.
I know there are also somebody who was sleeping in the elevator over there. So when it comes to our pit and towing count, like I said, it's done every 2 years. The 2026 hasn't come out. The tentative numbers from when we had done it, I think we were around 27, but you can see from 2019 to 2024 in Emeryville, there's been a huge decline, 178 down to 91, 38. Like I said, this past year, we were less than 30.
Okay, I have one more question. Sorry.
Yeah.
So Grants Pass versus Johnson, like, was a case that like happened in 2024, and it made it to where you can criminalize homelessness again. Before that, you couldn't. But is there a fee? Can the homeless people in Emeryville be ticketed? Is that why there's not as many?
Okay. No, we do not have any. We do. Our intention is not to make it punitive. The only time that we see that the police are, while the police may be called out, they also are aware, which is why they participate in our coordination meetings. Okay. The only time, like I'd say, at least within the past 8 months that I've seen someone get arrested is because they were fighting.
Mm-hmm.
They were fighting each other.
Okay.
But no, there's no penalty. There's no fine. There's no ticket that they're receiving here at Emeryville.
Okay.
But yeah, our numbers have definitely decreased. Alameda's numbers went up. They went down a little bit. We, of course, don't have any shelters here in Emeryville. We have, over the past 3 years, provided temporary shelter services at 4300 while we've been waiting to figure out how to redevelop that site. Our last service provider just moved out in April. And that was we've had a family shelter there, a woman's shelter, and then men and women, both service provider utilize that. And both from Oakland and Berkeley. There have been shelters in both locations that had to go through repairs that have come in at different times and utilized our space as temporary shelter.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, I think there was also another shelter that we had provided assistance to. But right now it's just St. Vincent de Paul. We also provide an annual contract to ECAP to help with their operational expenses related to providing the food bank. And then I'm trying to think what others. Oh, we have a new thing that we're trying to figure out. I'm sorry, I'm about to die here. Yeah, it's over here.
Another reason.
We have money from the state through the opioid settlement fund that we need to try to figure out how to spend. And some of that money can be used to address those who are unhoused or housed. And so in our new RFP that we have out there, we've identified those funds that we have available. And we want whoever's bidding to help us think through what is the best way to utilize this money here in Emeryville. That's one of the eligible uses. There's some other things we can do, but we need to start spending this money. It's not a lot of money. I think we have, like, on average, we're getting like $30,000 to $40,000 a year. So it can't stand up a huge program, but it can stand up something. In the past, we have spent some of that money for the police and getting training on Narcan usage.
Isn't exciting.
And that was like, you know, a couple thousand dollars. Like, I haven't just spent $40,000 every year.
Is it Mandela House in Emeryville?
It is not. Mandela House is in Oakland.
It is because it's
Oakland.
Around
what it can be spent on?
Yes.
What?
Has to be used to address what's the term?
Like, it's pretty public health oriented. So yeah. It's a lot of. It has to tie in pretty directly to opioids, so like paying for recovery services or any type of like education program relates strictly to opioids. So that was one of our challenges, is that it has to be very tied in.
And we don't have a public health department.
Yeah.
So like some of the uses, like we could pay for people who have opioid issues who are pregnant. I don't know how to stand up for. I don't even know if that's an issue here in Emeryville, but it's very opioid heavy. Recovery programs, people transitioning out of jail, mm-hmm. things that I think probably are much more easier for a county or a state to fund. Mm-hmm. But a city's got allocations of funding, so we need to figure out something.
What's it for again?
Okay. Opioid reduction or treatments. Yeah. And it can be educational. It can be actual funding, like a hospital program, a recovery program. Some cities have used the money to buy Narcan. But again, $40,000 a year, I don't know how much Narcan. It's a whole lot of Narcan.
That money is accruing.
It's about $40,000. Over the life of the program, which I think takes us to 2038, we will generate somewhere around $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about $40,000. There are a couple of years with large payments.
Mm-hmm.
Every payment that we get, it's like from 10 or 15 different CVS, Kroger, Walgreens, all these different companies are issuing payments, small payments, like $3,000 from this person and $2,000, but collectively we're getting somewhere close to $40,000 on average.
You said so we're coordinating with neighboring cities on a number of programs.
Mm-hmm. We coordinate efforts on what's happening.
Coordinate efforts. I mean, are there, you know, programs or coordinated efforts that maybe, you know, do cover opioid related issues, but then are also broader in scope that the funds could be used to?
Yeah, it's one of the things that we need to bring up. I think when I looked at the last report, Oakland is spending their money. I don't know what Berkeley's spending their money on.
I mean, well, now
or Albany.
Okay, but now we have in Emeryville public housing, like we're building across the street from me, from my work.
Nellie Hannon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of opioid users in there, I promise.
I literally know some of them.
Yeah. So I know that they're there. And I mean,
so that's a good point. We probably need to find Narcan. We need to talk with the Nellie Hannon to figure out in Lifelong, is there something?
Lifelong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm on the board at Lifelong. So you need to bridge me gap there.
I got you. Create a program? Is that what you're...
We need to think about what we can use the money for. We've asked in this RFP for someone to devise a program, you know, mm-hmm. tell us what program you think that, you know, you would want to implement here in Emeryville. Mm-hmm. It may not be a way of spending all the money, but we're trying to figure out ways that we can start spending mm-hmm. the money mm-hmm. instead of it going back to the state, which may end up being something like, again, I don't know how big of an opioid problem it is here in Emeryville that we need to create some brand new program. Mm-hmm. But our thought was, you know what, let's try to see if we can tie it into this work that we're doing here. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a way. We've also had some preliminary conversations about trying to talk with the school board, you know, the old school DARE programs. That's mm-hmm. another way that we could spend the money. Again, it's not going to spend $40,000, but it could mm-hmm. spend something.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but as much very low income housing as Emeryville is planning on, you know, having it, like there's that building, there's another building that's coming up on San Pablo, right? And mm-hmm. then and that's going to be very low income. And there's the other, I mean, that's where the money can be targeted. That's some of that.
We have to figure out the program. Yeah.
I mean, like if you, so we have to have our own like program. Like
we need to figure out a program. There luckily is a place for us to go to the state and explain what we want to do so that they can pre-approve it. Mm-hmm. So that we've gotten their blessing so that when we start spending the money, then it doesn't come back saying, oh,
we have to have our own like building that we have a program.
It has to be a building, but we just have to devise how it is we want to, or partner with the county and give the money to the county to use through something that they're doing.
Yeah, beds for rehab for our people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also too, if you're going to be logging the low income people, you have to have, you know, verify their income, and they have to, you know, it's a 50 year whatever, you mm-hmm. know, if you put all those people and have that as a service when they get their housing or when they're approved or even when they're not approved.
Have what is the service?
The opioid information as well.
Oh, so that's something that's available.
Yeah.
This is the other part of the last PIT count information, just kind of seeing kind of where we track compared to Alameda County as a whole in regards to race, in regards to gender, and then in regards to age. Our population is primarily male. Definitely I would say that 35 to 54 is where we're at.
Wait, in Emeryville, the general population?
Unhoused. Those who have been identified as unhoused through when we do the PIT count.
I see.
And so the PIT count does not capture those who are couch surfing. It is only those that were either identified in a shelter or who were identified as known in the area and or were visually seen on that specific day at that time. People went out to the count.
We're so close to West Oakland, like it would be worth maybe looking into just partnering with them with the funds.
Yeah, that could be definitely. I think we need to figure out the partnership probably from the West Oakland, what's happening over in the Mandela area.
Well, and right by
that's probably something we need to do too. Nailing in a gangway, that's a great idea. I hadn't thought about reaching out to them in lifelong. So we'll definitely put that. It's one of the things on my to-do list way back. And
yeah,
we just had a meeting. And so it's like, okay, I need to.
I can mention it to lifelong too.
I just had a meeting.
Because I think this is like important.
Yeah.
This could be a really good thing. Somebody, you know, people always talk about like when they get housing first, right? I don't know if I totally buy that all the time, but housing first, that works sometimes. But then if there's no support once they move into that housing, like how are they going to ever get better and thrive? But if there's a program specifically for like certain buildings or to Emeryville, then they could, you know. I mean, you can't make anybody go to treatment.
Right.
You can give them the information, encourage it, let them know that this program has been created, and let them, like, you know, and then when times get tough enough and they want to and they hit some bottom, then they can know, oh, well, that program, I go to that program, you know, that program will help pay for me to go to rehab. That's an important thing for people to know. And it's not like you're going to immediately clean people up, but I mean, it's, you know,
really providing them that opportunity.
Yeah. Some type of like outreach. I don't know. It makes me wonder too, like if there's another program like that goes around to the.
I need to have, area. You know, so we have those regional conversations with the county, and then we have our small hub meetings as well. And then sometimes there are these one-off meetings that we do. I need to see if we can put this opioid money on the agenda at some point and really talk about it. Like, how is everybody else really using this money? And are there ways that we could partner? Because again, you know, we're a small city and we're strapped with capacity. If somebody else is doing something that can also benefit Emeryville, and I'll give you the money as long as you let Emeryville, you know, residents have access, I think that's a great opportunity versus me trying to create something. And,
I don't know how to manage it.
You know,
one thing that strikes me on this, in these charts is just that the age range, I mean, that 65 plus jumped to 13.2%. That's kind of an interesting slice, because if you're talking about people who are going to be, you want to evaluate them for being able to earn an income and support themselves, but that's a fairly large slice, at least compared to, you know, even 55 to 64. You kind of have to treat that part of the population a little bit differently.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, which is why it's just one of the solutions. I mean, I think in, you know, when people talk about how the services that you offer to the Annales community, it's services where they are on the street. That's part of it. It's also, are there opportunities for them to get into a shelter bed, whether that's, you know, short term, long term, whatever it may be. Then it's also going into permanent supportive housing. And there have to be different solutions for different people. I think you're right. Those that are 65 plus, rapid rehousing is also another option. That may not be the right option for that target group. That target group might really more so need that permanent supportive housing.
But there were only 760 units the whole year last year, and there were 9,450 homeless people in Alameda County.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's not enough units. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's the correct data, I promise.
What it was. And at least through the funding that the state had, correct me if I'm wrong, through No Place Like Home, the requirement was for those supportive housing units that you had to have a severe disability and be homeless in order to get placed into permanent supportive housing. So all the units that had No Place Like Home had that additional requirement.
Yeah, but you know, when you think about it, I mean, at least like 70% of people on the street have permanent disabilities. Like they have a wide range of disabilities and like mental disabilities. Like there's a whole bunch of different stuff that goes on, and you don't make it long living on the street and not develop a disability. You didn't have one when we started.
Right.
I promise. Let's see. I mean, so that's not that requirement. You can get around, like not around, but you can.
I've heard there are ways the service providers know how to manage the system.
You know, you just have to tell you it's not necessarily lying, it's like really taking someone that has disabilities, but
yeah,
you're just recognizing them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, 13. I agree. And the older population kills me. I just can't stand it. You know, I wish we could house every single person that's over 65. You know, it's not. So, I mean, why doesn't Emeryville think of doing something? Well, I mean, because permanent housing is so expensive. Never mind. I'm just. There's just no good solution to this except for some billionaire coming and dropping up.
But these are, I just wanted to bring this up. These are the things we're working on again. We may end up having to make some modifications, but we do currently have that RFP out. If you know of any service providers that you think we should definitely look at it, let them know.
It's on the website. I don't want to tell you not to.
It's on the website. The last thing I have on the agenda is, you know, we're always scheduled to meet the first Wednesday of the month. For the month of June, I'm asking your guys' thoughts on rescheduling that meeting. And the reason I want to reschedule it for the middle of the month is our service provider is looking to get us their recommendations on the tenant protection project at the end of May. We need to do that review, and I want to be able to bring that information to you guys. So if we can move it to the middle of the month, that gives us time to at least do our initial review before we bring it to you guys. Additionally, HUD is supposed to be releasing their 2026 income and rent limits. It usually comes out in March or April. They put out a notice that it wasn't going to come out until May. Once they issue it, then the state has to adopt it. Then it comes back to us to issue our affordable housing table. So I'm trying to give us some time for that to come in. So I'd like to know what your guys' thoughts are on moving it to the middle of the month. And then is there a day that would work for everybody if we put it in the middle of June?
Doesn't matter.
It's 17th for me is better than the 10th. Okay. If we're still thinking.
It's up to you guys on what the day is.
Okay. Yeah, I'm cool with whatever. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, same day of the week, same time is probably the same for me.
Okay.
Can I ask one more question about housing? So wouldn't it be smarter to, like, instead of putting all this money aside for rapid rehousing and flex funds that we don't use, wouldn't it be smarter to, like, put that into homelessness prevention? Like, you know, because if you can prevent people from ever becoming homeless, you know, it seems like that would be like Keep Oakland Housed. You know, Keep Oakland Housed, you know, that program. You know, it'll give you $5,000 if you can, you know, if you're behind on your rent, you're about to become homeless.
Mm-hmm.
So why wouldn't, it seems like Emeryville would create a homelessness prevention program that could really make a difference, more so of a difference than the 12 people that are homeless in Emeryville.
Right. That is a great idea. So there's two things that we added to this RFP. One, we added a section on, what did I call it? Emergency housing placement. The intention of that is, let's say somebody got a order of eviction or a code order saying they had to vacate. If they don't have anywhere to go, that there would be funding set aside specifically, kind of like if we were going to step in on the temporary, but there's money set aside specifically for our service provider to issue payments and help them find a place to go for like the first couple of days. So we've added that to this program so that we can try to address those things. We get calls all the time from people who are like, I'm about to be homeless. I have nowhere to go. Can you help me? Mm-hmm. This potentially could be that solution.
Yeah.
The other thing that we added was we told them, is there another service that we're not providing that you think would work in Emeryville? Mm-hmm. And that really is to allow them, who knows better than me, because this is a new world for me that I'm still learning in, of what other services could we be providing that we're not, that you think could be beneficial.
Homelessness prevention.
So we've built that in there for them to tell us, and so that we can figure out what we want to do. The idea of doing some type of emergency rental assistance prevention, kind of homeless prevention, it's been talked about. When the city had it during COVID, we received funding from Wareham. They provided money to the city that funded that program. The city did kick in some additional money, but they provided us a grant, which is why we've had it. So the city would have to figure out how much money, what are the terms, making sure we have somebody available to man it. But I think that's always something out there that we definitely need to figure out. Can we provide, is there funding we can set aside? And you're right, maybe it is taking it from the rapid rehousing.
Mm-hmm.
It's great that you've already have some experience with exactly that kind of program, right? To make it easier to stand up.
Mm-hmm. when we did that program, Bax actually administered it on our behalf. Yeah. So they did all the reviewing of the eligibility and all those kind of things. But it is something that's needed, and it's a good idea. I had not thought about during the emergency, like those $5,000, about putting that in here. Maybe somebody will come up with that. But even if they don't, it's something that we can keep in the back of our mind and talk with them when we do our interview process about their abilities to do that.
Sorry, I have to go. I'm sorry, but you, I mean, this can, yeah, I'm sorry, I could geek out forever on homeless. I'm just like, I could, so that's my last issue. I'm gonna turn it over to Tyler. Oh, close us out. Okay, just close us out. Okay, so the meeting for the Emeryville Housing Committee
on May 6th is adjourned at 8:15 p.m.
And June 17th, when I'm hearing, I'll send out the notice for everybody.
Thank you.
Sorry, I try to keep things short, but it doesn't always work. Oh, here, this is yours.
Hey, Valerie, since I,
Oh, thank you.
The neighbor Tommy was telling me that,
Hold on, I'm still recording. Let me turn it off. I gotta figure out how to turn it off.
So Valerie's great at knowing what you're going to ask next.
Yeah.
You know, she always like answers the question right
there. Oh my God, you guys are like, because you're like, oh, I got this. Go ahead, I got a slide for you.
Sorry.
Bye. Thank you. See you next month.